But actually, every day you walk onto the set, it's incredibly stimulating and exciting. Every time you want, you see what the new set is, every time you see a new script, every time you discover who the new guest star is going to be, every time you get to be Doctor Who, which is what happens to me. I go to work and I've got to try and be Doctor Who. That remains for me immensely exciting.
These are the Target Files, Doctor Who, Season 10 Reviews. Join us now as we discuss the final season of Peter Capaldi as the Doctor and Stephen Moffat as showrunner.
Hello, welcome to the Doctor Who Target Files podcast. Episode 37 we're at now, actually, and this time we are discussing last night's episode in the UK and around the world, The Empress of Mars, written by Mark Gatiss and directed once more in this directing block by Wayne Yip. This is Mike in Swansea.
Hello, this is Alex in Exeter.
So, Al, your initial thoughts on another Mark Gatiss Ice Warrior story, his second after Cold War a few years back?
Thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was a very good plot and well written. It went along very well. I think this one was slightly better than Cold War's. It was a better depiction of the Ice Warriors. I think more interesting sort of war creatures than just sort of a reptile popping out of a suit, really. This is what Cold War was mainly about. And I think the plot was a lot better than Mark Gatiss' last attempt, basically doing the Ice Warriors. And it went along very well. There was lots of connection to the Victorians and the Ice Warriors and how quite similar they were. And I thought bits with the Doctor and Pearl were great, and the way the Doctor was sort of mainly important to the story, but had sort of a background. So it wasn't there as much as he needed to be. It was just right level, I thought. So what do you think about it?
Put it down in the Victorian parlance, Al. A fun, good-going romp. I thought Corks a Lordy, it's good, as Jago and Lightfoot might say. Sort of elements of the Victorian stories we know that Mark Gatiss grew up watching, like Talons of Weng Chiang, particularly the Victorian setting. Elements of Zulu as well, the whole idea of empire up on Mars. Yeah, another good one, just a good, fun episode, I think. Some dark themes, but good fun overall.
Yeah, I would agree. It did have that nice fun to it, and it didn't feel ridiculously dark like it could have been with Ice Warriors. Yeah, I did enjoy it. I thought it had nice pace and it had good characters. And I think it definitely has that sort of feel back to things like, you know, Rider Haggard sort of books and stuff from Victorian periods. I think it did work.
Say again what a big fan I am of Wayne Yip and his directing again. Right at the start, we had this wonderful comic moment with NASA in the present day, look up onto Mars and seeing a message that we see later in the episode being set up by the Victorian soldiers. How do you find that introduced us well to the episode, Al?
Yeah, I thought that was a really good introduction, because you think it's going to be one thing with the whole sort of NASA space thing with the Doctor, and then it turns out to be something completely different. And I really like the way that you think what's being put there is for, you know, the Queen Victoria in that period, but it turns out to be for somebody completely different. So I won't spoil in case you haven't seen it yet.
Yes, and a lovely introduction of the Doctor in the NASA countdown.
Oh yeah, I really thought that was very fun. You know, going, oh, I love a countdown at the end. Those sort of first bits are sort of really fun, give it a nice sort of pace to it, I thought.
Yeah, I was a little bit sort of confused after the credits, because we went straight in the TARDIS to Victorian era, I suppose you would say, at Mars. That wasn't made brilliantly clear until we actually saw the soldiers. But I did notice a really lovely direction shot from Wayne Yip. We saw the TARDIS spinning sort of on its way to Mars. Encapsulated that spin into the TARDIS from the upper decks when you go and see it in the experience in Cardiff and you have the upper rail. He sort of expanded that into the movement, and I thought it was a really good camera shot, that.
Yeah, that looked really nice. It all include all bits of the TARDIS. I thought, why have we got Victorians there? But I did think the same.
Yeah, it's not a major criticism. It's just something that confused me for a little while. And then, of course, we arrived on Mars. You know, pretty quickly we had Pearl Mackey falling down a hole. And I'm amazed that these modern companions can get away with all these pratfalls and things when you consider way back in the Five Doctors.
I was thinking that, and as he falls into quite a nasty, deep cavern, and he's perfectly fine after a few minutes, you know. But it was a clever trick of getting Nardo back to the TARDIS, so it does work.
A little bit of intrigue set up at first. He had a humorous introduction in the NASA space station earlier on, but not more or less sidelined. We know Matt hasn't got a major part in every episode this series. As we spoke to him the other day on episode 36, a bonus interview with the lovely Matt Lucas, folks, if you want to hunt down and listen to that on iTunes, Jellycast and Mixcloud and the Doctor Who Podcast Alliance. But digressing again, yeah, he was sidelined a bit. You know, there was enough other central characters in this story to really keep it going at a humorous and at times dark pace, Al.
They just got to level with Nardo, you know, not, because he doesn't want to be in every episode, otherwise people will get slightly annoyed back with his character. He's just brilliant, whatever he does. But yeah, there's so many extra little characters with all the soldiers having really good personalities. Each one is there for a purpose, I thought. So I thought that really worked.
Yes, reading Mark Gatiss in the latest Doctor Who magazine, saying an interesting fact about how he found these names of these soldiers within the Victorian battalion. I think he said Cat's Love he found from a book he read in research based around the lives of soldiers within that time period. And God's Acre he said he actually found on a tombstone in a cemetery somewhere. And he actually says, oh, the best names for characters are always found, for historical characters are always found in tombstones.
Most definitely, always great names, and there's always really good names in Mark Gatiss' things. But it's just really, I think the characters of each of those characters of the soldiers had such a, you know, sort of good point and purpose of being there right to the end. We get that great twist.
Yeah, you know, we had Catch Love and God's Acre. Catch Love, the one who sort of freely admits he's, well, been seen as a coward, unfortunately, back in those days before the idea of PTSD was recognised amongst forces personnel. And we had the opposite, power-hungry God's Acre, who came across as a real sort of arrogant, pompous idiot, didn't he?
Oh, most definitely. He's the typical sort of bluff English soldier who, you know, does anything for money and gold. Basically, that's how, you know, the Friday with the reference to Friday, you know, is there as the sort of person who's going to give them all this sort of gold, and that's why they're there. It's a complete trick, really.
Yeah, the actor who played God's Acre, Ferdinand Kingsley, he had this wonderful affecting face throughout, which is such a face of superiority, I thought. He was almost speaking to every character, the Doctor, the Ice Warrior, the other soldiers, as if they weren't worthy of his time.
Oh, totally. He was doing a lot with expression, and the way his voice was, it's like, you know, you're all underneath me, really, and that's officer and, you know, regiment outlook of, you know, people in that period would have been, you know, what, I'm the best, basically.
Yeah, people have pointed out as well, the actor is in the Victoria series, Queen Victoria, her younger days with Jenna Coleman on ITV, and were they going to put Jenna in the photograph as Queen Victoria, but it did turn out to be Pauline Collins from Tooth and Claw in the end.
I thought that's what I've seen before. I was thinking, my brain was going, I've seen that actor before, but yeah, I'm surprised they didn't do that, putting Gemma in as Queen Victoria, but they have the original one, which is good still.
Yeah, I think we have to talk about it at the end. That's actually reminded me of something. I know Pauline Collins, when she returned for Tooth and Claw, had gone the longest period, I believe, in episodes of Doctor Who, between appearances, because she appeared in the Troughton story, The Faceless Ones, back in the mid-60s, and then it was 40 years later we had Tooth and Claw. Although, come to think of it now, I'm just wondering if Margaret John, who passed away famously in Gavin and Stacey over here in the UK, she may have had a long gap between The Idiot's Lantern in that same second series of the RTD era and a previous appearance with one of the classic Doctors. But it always brings up these interesting moments, Al, and that takes me on. We'll skip towards the end, folks. Spoilers, but if you haven't seen the episode, but I hope you have. But we had a rather interesting returning cameo at the end, Al, voiced by the same actress who voiced the character in the John Pertwee era, Alpha Centauri.
We did, and that was a nice little nod to the past, really, and the connection with the Ice Warriors, and from that bit of Peladon, those sort of Ice Warriors. And I thought that worked very well. It was a blink moment, you miss it sort of thing. Well, I think it worked.
Yeah, you know, I put this on Facebook and it got a few likes. It was in good humour, folks. There were rumours about this being a Peladon story during the production phase when we knew Mark Gatiss was writing a story with the Ice Warriors in. There were rumours of Alpha Centauri making an appearance, but people were wondering how on earth they were going to get away with it these days, because let's just say Alpha Centauri looks a lot like a certain part of the human anatomy.
Very phallic symbols he looks like.
That's the phallic word, Al, yeah. Phallic is the word. How on earth are they going to get away with it in Modern Who? But I think they did it well on the video screen by just showing the eye.
You couldn't see anything. Everybody knows what she sort of looks like from the sort of... Phallic got away with it in the sort of two Peladon episodes, because it did very much look like a rubber phallic symbol, but it's just the best way of describing him or her.
Yeah, I'm sure it was joked about in those more civil days, shall we say, by adults watching the show back then in the 70s.
I expect it was. I just think it was a nice nod to the past, what Mark Gatiss likes doing, I think.
Yeah, and I like the sort of way the video screen was set up to be sort of hexagonal. It had that sort of element of the 70s and even the 80s Doctor with the Five Doctors video screens on it, didn't it? But they sort of blended it in with sort of modern grading on the edges, the modern colours, but it would fit in well in either era.
Yeah, I think it had nice sort of references to the past Doctors and to the present, I think. I think Mark Gatiss, you know, is steeped in all that period.
Just want to talk a little about, what did you make of the death scenes, Al? I thought they managed to balance between being pretty horrific in mind, but they managed to show the way Ice Warriors dispose of their victims without any blood, which is important, but becoming a crumpled mess was still quite horrific.
I thought they were really well done, because they were very nasty still, and there's those bits with the Ice Queen where you think she's going to give mercy and kills that soldier out in blinking. I thought they were very nasty. Well, they were just right side of nasty. There wasn't any sort of body horror or gore and guts, basically. It was just like, bang, and you're gone, basically. So I think it's very nasty, but I think it works on a friendly level. You could watch that quite easily, I think.
Yeah, I did giggle when I saw it, because I had read a preview earlier in the week, and one of the potential spoilers they put in was... the deaths will remind you of a beach ball, and it did, the way they sort of folded in on themselves and bounced away.
Oh, yeah, did a little bit, to be honest. They were sort of beach ball-y.
So if your children are having nightmares, folks, just think, I think beach ball might work, turning it into a more sort of humorous Doctor Who demise. Yeah, talking about those death scenes, I thought it was well set up as well. We had a young soldier called Vince who was explaining to an older soldier that he was about to get married. Sometimes, as a used trope in films, that's often used as the very next person to get offed, isn't it? The very next person to get killed. But they did leave it a little while in the episode. They sort of teased us a bit, because I thought Vince was going to escape, and then he was taken out a few scenes later, unfortunately.
I know, you were hoping from the minute they started coming through the floor, the Ice Warriors, that Vince was going to escape and he'd be all happy. No, he gets done away with as well, and the other bluff sort of soldier gets taken first. So he did... think there was going to be some hope for Vince, but no, nothing lasts in Ice Warrior land.
They teased us and they pulled the rug away from us again. Naughty Gatiss.
Totally.
Yeah, talking about the performances, Al, Peter Capaldi, pretty mesmeric again. Somewhat haunted look towards the end, we'll talk about that. But there were definite elements, particularly in the pronunciation here. When he first became across the Ice Warrior, there was a line about things going very badly. And he just sort of put a resonance on the very badly phrase, which was pure Tom Baker for me.
Totally. There's really beautiful dialogue in this, what he gives over so greatly. And the sort of whole warriors who he understands completely, because, you know, he's been a warrior now. He sort of understands the Ice Warriors better, I think. And there's just some great bits with Peter Capaldi in this episode, and the way Bluff soldiers try to overrule him and he manages to convince him. But, you know, the way he words things is fantastic.
Yes, and then towards the end, when he was standing by the Gigantium machine, he stood there and authoritatively said, you know, what the potential disastrous outcomes could be for both sides in this conflict. I just purely went into the zone of thinking it was Sylvester McCoy. I could almost see, even though Peter had the sort of space suit on, I could almost see Sylv standing there with his cape, with his umbrella in front of him and his hat, just sort of lecturing them.
There was that whole film with Sylv's doctor, I think.
Yeah, so he's definitely borrowing some elements of other doctors. You know, a lot of people have mentioned since he was first cast about the Pertwee references in his outfit. I'm definitely seeing a lot of Tom this year, and definitely Sylvester's doctor last night.
I would agree that there are definitely lots of bits of Tom there, and definitely some bits of Silv. It sort of worries me a little bit, because it is a great performance, but are people really getting it?
I wonder. He does seem to have a little bit of a haunted look about him too. We'll talk about the end again soon, Al. Yeah, I'm wondering if the Doctor is keeping something to himself, as was teased at the end, and it seems to be he's holding something back, not just in the performance, but just in the way his Doctor seems to be.
He knows something's coming, I think.
Yeah, and on to Pearl Mackie as Bill. I thought she was very self-assured in this episode. Hints again of sort of Victorian, hints of misogyny, possible hints of racist undertones in the story as well. Sort of subtly done when they mentioned that they'd called the Ice Warrior, they saw him as a slave almost, and they'd called him Friday, hadn't they, after the slave in Robinson Crusoe.
Because it's period, unfortunately, that there are feelings of Victorian where, like, you know, slaves and women being downtrodden. I find it's interesting that the person the Ice Queen speaks to most and wants to begin with is Bill. So there is that woman-to-woman outlook throughout this. So I think it's there, unfortunately, the nastier side of Victorian life, but also the way life is now, I think.
Onto the soldiers, you had the catch love. There was the misogyny there when he said to Bill, oh, he joked about the idea of a woman ever being able to become a policeman or a soldier. And then within a few minutes, you know, Bill had stood up to him, and he sort of backed down and admitted his cowardice. But then towards the end again, he actually assassinates the other soldier, Catchlove. So I was in a little bit of a quandary about how I should feel about the character, really. You know, there was darkness, there was lightness to him as well.
Yeah, I think he's a very interesting character, because he's obviously still suffering what we would call, like, PTSD or shell shock back then, and it's like, he sort of flips between being the coward and the hero, and I expect at some point he'd probably go back to being the coward, you know, if it's the bottom personality with people like that. But it's a very interesting one, because he has all the Victorian sort of parts of, like, you know, women are, you know, not, won't never be police women, and, you know, sort of laughs his head off about that, but respects the sort of queen of the, you know, the Ice Warrior. So it's a very, I know, I'm like you, I'm not too sure where to place him.
I suppose I was pretty pleased with the ending, that he did survive and he did live to go and serve the Ice Warriors.
Yeah, I think the ending was a good ending. God Save the Queen, which is actually the Ice Queen, not Victoria. I think that's meant to represent. But I think it was all wrapped up nicely, but I don't know if his character, you sort of expect at some point for him to maybe disagree with the Ice Queen or go.
The introduction of a female Ice Warrior this time, played very well by Adele Lynch. What did you think of her performance?
Oh, I thought her performance was spectacular. It was really quite nasty and quite sinister. And that whole bit of that first shot where, you know, when the soldiers are trying to get the diamonds and he snaps his head once he comes out, I thought was very menacing. Lots of bits throughout her scenes. Very, very sort of scary. And you don't know where she's going to go. Is she going to kill everybody or not? So I think she was brilliant.
I thought she had both the grace and the, well, regalness, really, of an Ice Warrior, didn't she? I mean, we had the other male Ice Warrior earlier on in the scene who had been sort of playing the role of a subordinate while the Gigantium gun was being built when they found him on Earth. Thought she brought the sort of regality back to it, didn't she? The sense of honour. You could say in the Hooniverse that the Sontarans are probably the thug warriors of the alien races, aren't they? With their sort of false honour. But then you have the Ice Warriors, who have the real sort of regality about the sort of, yes, oxymoronic idea of war and culture together, you know, but they do have that more sort of regal look about them, don't they, than the Sontarans, who are the out-and-out thugs of the Doctor Who villains.
I think the Ice Warriors have always been to be sort of more regal towards other villains like Sontarans, you know, love the war and that's it. Well, I think the way it's played, where the male Ice Warriors in this have basically been turned into that sort of servant war person, like with the Ice Queens, he still all has the dignities. I think it really worked with different layers what happened, because you have to imagine that Friday the Ice Boy has been with humans, so he has slightly turned himself into a human, I think, by the time we see him.
This is Alex Gibbon's Doctor Who News Round.
Hello, this is Alex, and this is Hughes News on the 11th of June. First thing we need to mention is the very bad figures for last night's Doctor Who episode, Empress of Mars. 3.58 million watched it and made it the sixth most watched thing last night, which, to be bluntly honest, is very low for an excellent episode of Doctor Who. The final figures also for Pyramid at the End of the World are finally out, and they are 5.79 million and 14th overall most watched thing, which is still very low for another great episode. BigFinish.com news this week. Big Finish have announced that with the 8th Doctor, is going to have a new companion, played by the excellent actress Rakeen Fakwa, who, if you watch EastEnders, you will know her from there. She played an excellent character in there, and is now going to be alongside Paul McGann's 8th Doctor for the first volume of The Time War from BigFinish.com. Available to pre-order now, and comes out in November. Also out last Tuesday, but well worth getting, is The Lives and Loves of Captain Jack. It is the spin-off from Torchwood, which contains just Captain Jack, and you find out what happens to him straight after the final of episode 1, where we saw him turned into the immortal Captain Jack we all love now. Has great supporting cast of Katie Manning, Russell Tovey and Sarah Douglas. It is well worth a download, as it's a very good audiobook and gives you much more detail into Captain Jack's backstory.
Okay, Al, we need to talk a little about the ending and cliffhanger for The Empress of Mars. Nardole go off earlier in the episode and need to require the help of Missy to get the TARDIS back to Mars, and the Doctor saw her in the TARDIS at the end of the episode with a very grave look on his face, and to increase that element of a grave feeling, she was asking if he was okay, and he looked rather shocked, and she gave a little look towards his two hearts. What did you make of that, Al?
It's a very interesting cliffhanger, because you don't know if she somehow managed to make the TARDIS come back earlier in the episode, so sort of Nardole is sort of forced to help, you know, get help from her, basically. I think it's going to be something connected to next week or the finale, I think, because the way she looked at his two hearts was quite ominous, and the way he looked at her was like, why on earth are you here? You know, to be locked in the vault. It's quite ominous outlook for him, I think.
Does she know that perhaps he's in some way within a regeneration already and holding it back?
You know, we had the sort of fake regeneration last week, but has that sort of semi also started the whole regeneration? We don't know. That's why she is he well? Is she planning something? We don't know quite yet.
Yes, we know Peter Capaldi has said this regeneration will be slightly different. He said something that hasn't been done before. So does the Doctor know the time and the place of it? Does he know how it occurs? Has he seen it in some sort of flash forward in his own timeline previously that we haven't seen on screen?
Yeah, there's so many what ifs. And I don't know if you heard the interview with Steve Moffat this week, where he said it's completely different. Him and Chris Chibnall have talked, and the regeneration is going to be something you've never seen before. So it's a really interesting one, because what's going to happen? You know, I think Missy is definitely up to something. She's still playing good, apparently, but it's a very weird one.
Building up nicely for the remaining three episodes now, and next week, very much looking forward to Rona Monroe coming back to the series after Survival 28 years ago now, the final episode of the classic series. Thankfully, nowadays, the series is in safer and more stable hands than it was back in those days. But hopefully she can give us something to rival the excellent Survival.
It's only going to be one episode where we had a full classic episode. Yeah, like four episodes, which gave her story a really nice big feeling. Well, what we've seen from the trailer, it does look very interesting. I think it's very nasty insect creatures who eat light or something. It's going to be a good one, I think.
Yeah, it's a nice completion of a circle, really, for me, because I think Russell T. Davies himself has said, if you look back at Survival, that gives you the template of New Who, really, in terms of a suburban setting, the everyday creepiness, and he says you can see that right throughout everything he put into Rose. The fact she's now come back to this 45-minute format is a nice payback.
Yeah, I think it's a very good connection, but I'd like it to be very dark. I'd like it to be more, you know, I'd like it to be as dark as Survival, because I always felt very dark for the time period, but I can see where Russell's connections are to the whole sort of estate and Rose and all that. So I think it will be a good one.
Yeah, historical setting. Of course, again, the idea of Picts and the Romans, something that's based on a real part of history. I think I'll have to read up a little bit more on it in time for our review next week.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely based on an actual event that happened, I think, between the Romans and the Picts. They were like one of the English tribes up north, basically, you know, instead of people who are involved with the Romans. And the whole legion is meant to have vanished somehow. What, there's never been sort of proved how. But you'll go into more depth that next time. But I just think it's going to be really good, because Roman never does anything bad.
And it just week after week, this series just seems to be very good, Al.
Yeah, I think it's been very good for, you know, people who actually are Who fans. But I don't know if the general, you know, people just come in and out of watching Doctor Who have got it, really. I think it's been brilliant, personally. But I think the people who keep Doctor Who going, unfortunately, you know, money-wise and viewer-wise, haven't really got it, unfortunately.
So we need to return now and give our scores on The Empress of Mars.
We do indeed.
So overall for you, Al, what did you think?
Well, I thought it was a really good episode. I thought it was directed beautifully. There's some really lovely shots in it. And I thought, you know, Mark Gatiss has got a really tight script here again. You know, it's one of his better ones. I'm pretty glad he didn't do a, like he was planning a sequel to Sleep No More from last year, because that would have been terrible. But yeah, I think the characters are all very good. You've got really good things between the different elements of the Victorians and the Ice Warriors worked really well. The Doctor, Bill and Nada were great as normal. They had a really good script there with great lines for all three of them. So I'm going to give it a 10, I think.
Wow, 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 wow. So one of the very best of this series for you again.
I think so. It's just worked from start to finish. There wasn't a bit where I thought, this doesn't work.
Pressure on me now. Just a fun Doctor Who episode, really. I really am going to go on about Wayne Yip again. There's a bit of a bromance here from me for him as a director. I think he's been very, very good. But I did notice that in a few episodes of Class he did. Very sort of stylistic, very gothic element to many episodes. And yeah, I love the way this episode was lit in the caves. The humour, the balance, the direction, everything. I can't find a lot of fault now, really. I was going to sort of score it down about an 8 or something. You're pushing me up and you're pushing me up.
I know, this is the problem. I did sit down and watched it twice and see, was there anything what jumped out at me? There was nothing.
And I think it might be just as good in future rewatches. I'm going to say 9, Al, but I'm wondering why I'm knocking anything off, really, because I did really enjoy it.
It's really enjoyable, isn't it? I know, well, that's understandable. There must be something. Well, maybe that beginning bit.
Sorry, it's not Mark Gatiss' fault or anyone, but it's that theme tune. The theme tune, it still hasn't been changed after 3 years. I can only give it a 9. No.
Actually. I tell you what I really want changed is the opening graphics now.
Yes. I think they do need to have a change. They've been there for the whole of the Capaldi era, and you consider Matt Smith had different ones, didn't you? I think David Tennant had slightly different tone in various series.
You know, the graphics and the music hasn't really been thought out for a few years now. I think that's one of the things we need change for the first of the Chris Chibnall years, I think.
But to be honest, Al, when I was rewatching this morning, I almost accept that theme tune that I don't really like now, because the episodes are so good, so I'm going to rescore. Sorry, folks, I'm going to give it a 10, like Al. A quick change there.
It's my fault.
It's a good correction, though, Al. It's a very, very good episode. Probably up there with... how would you compare it to the other Gatiss episodes? I'd say it's right up there with
I would say it's as good as the Charles Dickens episode.
The Unquiet Dead, I was going to say, but I also have a lot of love for the one with Dame Diana Rigg and her daughter.
Oh, that one. I put that second. What's that called? The
Crimson Horror.
Crimson Horror. That is definitely my second favorite Mark Gatiss. And then I do quite like, because they're quite funny, Victory for the Daleks.
Yeah, that's a bit of a Marmite one for some people. I'd probably have that a little bit further down.
I don't like what they actually did to the Daleks in that, the way they brought them back. They looked terrible when they brought them back.
Yeah.
But I like the script, and I thought the bits were quite funny when they were offering Churchill that cups of tea. They're always quite funny.
I think the heart and the emotion is always there in Mark Gatiss' stories.
But I think it got slightly lost in the last two. I also like Robots to Show. That was good.
Yeah, I did like that. I went to see that being filmed, of course.
Yeah, but I think the last time Sleep No More was not great.
No. I mean, I mean to go back and rewatch that one because, you know, it may improve.
I watched it recently, and even on the second one, it's better, but it's slightly annoying still.
Yeah, sometimes it's to do perhaps with the direction of some of the Matt Gaetis stories. I think those three are at the very top of his game, the ones we mentioned, The Unquiet Dead, The Crimson Horror, and Empress of Mars. So, you know, I hope he can contribute more in the future, really. And I do like the way, along with Cold War, that he's written The Ice Warriors. I think there's a lot more menace in them than there was in the classic series.
I thought there was great, really good menace in, on the first, I wasn't on the second watch, but on the first watch, I thought it was really good menace when you saw Friday sort of stomping along. Those camera shots were really quite scary.
Yeah, just the camera shots of the feet, weren't they, you know, in slow-mo.
They really were. It was quite, not on the second watch, you knew it was coming, but on the first watch, it was really quite scary. So I think he has got Ice Warriors back there quite menacing in this.
But I do think we might have finished Wayne Yip's directing block now, Al, so I don't know if the man I'm having a bromance for is going to be back next week.
I think we're okay because next one's Charlie Palmer.
Yeah, Charles Palmer next week.
Yeah, I thought it was Charles Palmer next one.
And then episode 11 we have up to in Doctor Who magazine, the current issue. That's Rachel Talalay for the finale. So,
do you think, because you know, it's getting very, we've only got three episodes left, when are they going to drop the John Sim?
I think possible cliffhanger, Al, at the end of next week's. I think Rona will have written, you know, the majority of the episode, and then Stephen will have slotted another scene in.
I reckon, because they can't really leave it any much longer, can they? Unless they leave it right to the end episode 12, sorry.
Spoiler, folks, I know that the finale is set somewhat on a giant spaceship where time is dilating, so...
Well, I don't know if that's the complete end of the season. Well, that is definitely where the last episode before is.
Or episode 11, so it's possible we'll see Sim as a lead into that one, but... Yeah, really looking forward to it. I think you know a series is going well when it seems to be going too fast.
This season has been fantastic. Every episode has been good. But I think that's just Doctor Who. The problem is, I think that's just Doctor Who fans who think that.
That's true, yeah. Not enough people are seeing it, but we can hope people discover this series on catch-up and DVD downloads.
Or Blu-ray or anything, because it is definitely, since the Russell T. Davies period, I would say it's the best season.
Best for me since Moffat's first, you know, Matt's first series 5. Best for me
since season 5 or season 8 are brilliant, and then season 9 was a bit hit and miss, I think. The rating should be up in the 6 to 8 million just on the first watch.
Well, it's ultimately, Al, we've got these three episodes. We'll have a break till Christmas. We'll have another break till the Chibnall series. So it's not as if it's going to get pulled off air in that period.
No, I don't think it's going to get pulled off, but I reckon it's in... Sort of, you know, with high-end BBC, I expect they aren't liking these ratings. That's what always worries me.
Maybe are, but they know they've got a brand that makes money.
Next time on the Target Files Season 10 podcast, we will be discussing The Eaters of Light by Rona Munro and directed by Charles Palmer.
Contact us on Twitter at @DWTargetFiles, all lowercase, or search Facebook for the Doctor Who Target Files podcast. Thanks for listening. Doctor Who Target Files, Empress of Mars Review, featured Michael Winks and Alexander Gibbons. I Am the Doctor, composed originally by Murray Gold. Version for the podcast by YouTube channel user Vale Mystery, that's V-A-Y-L-E Mystery. Please do check out their other work. Newsround opening and closing cues, composed originally by Ted Heath and his orchestra and by John Baker. Doctor Who Target Files, Empress of Mars Review was recorded in Swansea, South Wales and Exeter, Devon, England during June 2017.